If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Well, you may have heard that Professor Musa Mashabela, new incoming Vice Chancellor of UCT, has officially accepted that job at UCT. And we had spoken to many, many, many times during COVID. You may remember that. But he is on the line with us. And congratulations are in order, Prof. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening to you, Pamela, and thanks for inviting me, and greetings to your listeners.
You're an outsider at UCT, probably coming in with fresh new ideas. You know, you don't come with the baggage of UCT itself. Is that daunting to you, that you're coming into an environment that I suppose, as I said, you're an outsider of, and maybe, you know, you're not in the inner circle? Does that daunt you?
There's definitely pros and cons to it, if you really think about it. I think, you know, an insider will have an advantage of knowing the ins and outs of the institution, the people, you know, the experiences, the kind of things that we don't read about in the media, you know, or that are not in the public. They sort of find cultural issues that sometimes you can only understand when you're in an environment.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, you have an outsider who may come in, of course, with a more objective mind, fresh ideas, sort of, you know, using the, I suppose, for lack of a better word, the ignorance of what's been happening as a fresh point of departure for discussion around things that, you know, maybe normalized or seen to be normalized at UCT. So there's definitely pros and cons. I do think that overall, given where UCT is, it may not be a bad idea for UCT to have someone from outside. My view at the beginning was that the next VC of UCT should come from within the ranks of UCT. But a lot of colleagues essentially spoke to me and, you know, and said to me that, no, they don't really have anyone inside. They actually need someone from outside to come in and help heal. Anyone from outside would have been also affected by what's happened, and they need someone who's not affected by that.
You didn't waste any time when you were already telling, you know, everybody, the public, about some of the work that you want to do, and you want to centralize financial inclusion and some of your objectives. And this, they say, is some of the things that you've brought up even in your interviews. Why is that so important to you?
It's important to me because it's my own personal journey, you know. I think that when you grow up in South Africa and you grow up in an environment that is not privileged, you get robbed of possible opportunities. You know, when I wanted to go to varsity, I also wanted to go to UCT. I wanted to go to vets. But because of my circumstances, I couldn't, and I was not accepted in those institutions. So I ended up going to University of Natal then, which became University of KwaZulu-Natal. And when I look back, I think that, you know, if it wasn't for an institution like University of KwaZulu-Natal that made it possible to be inclusive, I would not been included. I would not have been included. But also, you know, now UCT is also benefiting from what University of Natal did back then, you know. So I'm of the view, therefore, that if you are UCT and your focus is to be a bedrock of talent, to be that point where the best minds come together, then, you know, these best minds must also include those who may not be as privileged, and yet they are still talented. They are still amongst the best, you know, amongst the most gifted in the country or on the continent. So we have to create that space. It's not me saying that, you know, we must just bring in people because of you know, lack of privilege, people who, because they're poor. No, I'm saying that amongst people who are underprivileged, you've got some of the most talented people that may not be able to get into UCT, and they should get into UCT.
And of course, this is on the backdrop of a very difficult economic situation. UCT, like many universities in South Africa, is a public entity. You know, the public purse is going through a lot at the moment. So you still want to excel and compete amongst the best in the world. And some of those are private institutions with really nice purses. So quite a difficult balance to strike there.
Yeah, it's so interesting. A couple of years ago, I was invited to apply for a job. It was be a director of global health at Brown University in the US. And one of the things that became a point of contention was exactly that, because I'm used to the South African environment where funding comes from government for the most part, or the students who are paying fees. And yes, those institutions thrive basically on third stream income, funding that comes from other sources than government or students. Students have to pay, but a lot of money comes from endowment, rich people who give to the university. And they've got a whole machinery that works to support that. And they're independent. They've got flexibility in terms of what they can do. So we have to compete with those institutions. And UCT, given the fact that it is a top institution in South Africa and on the continent, represents the whole continent on the global stage. And we wanted to stay in those top 100, top 200 universities in the world. But almost all of them are going to the private institutions that have the level of flexibility and resources that UCT may not. And I think we are also constrained by the laws, because you get funding from government and you are under the Public Higher Education Act, you are also constrained by the laws of the country. You don't have the flexibility. If we talk about equity targets, you must meet the same equity targets that everyone in the country needs to meet. And yet you are saying that you're a global institution. So it creates a little bit of a tension. And it's something that I think UCT is going to have to navigate. I don't think that an institution like UCT can even be compared to my institution, which is predominantly black. And we compete mostly on the African. We compete mostly on the African continent. And UCT, we're expected to compete globally with Harvard, with Oxford, with Brown, with, you know? So, and we take pride in that as South Africans, you know? As Africans, we take pride in it. And yet we don't make it easy for UCT to be able to do that. And so I'm hoping that we can have those conversations, even for government to understand, or at least have a pact and agree that, yes, we want UCT to compete at this level. And these are some of the relaxations in the rules we can give UCT in order to compete at that level. But these are the obligations it must have, for the fact that it is in South Africa, it is in the Western Cape, it is here, it is on the continent. So we could debate those. So for me, I think that, you know, it's imperative that if we want to be compete in the world, that we are positioned and we've got the levers that can help us to compete on that stage.
I'll pick up on this in a short while after a break, and I'm also going to open the lines, Prof, because I think many people are really happy that you are taking this up, and we were quite certainly excited ourselves. So I'm going to open the lines. If anybody wants to call in, they're welcome to do that. 086-000-00959. I'm in conversation with Professor Musa Moshabela, who is the incoming Vice Chancellor at UCT. The incoming UCT VC, Professor Musa Moshabela, is on the line with us as we congratulate him and look forward to some of the things that he wants to implement at UCT. Prof, before we went for a break, we were speaking about, you know, how UCT can compete globally and some of the things that may need to be considered. Do you want to throw some ideas at us? At what are the things that may need to be considered? Maybe one.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that you could think about, for example, is in terms of sources of income, right? So if you have to take funding from sources that are considered to be private interests, mm-hmm. people can be concerned that those private interests would influence the institution in a direction that mm-hmm. they do not want it to go. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, the people that are moving to Cape Town who have money may be interested, and they may be coming from other countries and so forth. And this can be, if you're not careful, this can be very concerning for South Africans mm-hmm. if they were to become aware of it, even for government. So for me, I think that it's not a matter to be taken lightly if you're going to think financial sustainability of the institution. And the reality is that people who are in these countries abroad, they're the ones who are used to giving to universities. Our wealthy people are not used to doing that. I find it interesting when some of our wealthy people are actually giving to Harvard and not necessarily to our institutions locally. Mm. So we have to talk about it and be critical about it in terms of whether we are going to target, philanthropists who are on the continent, in the country, and what would be the trade-offs of doing that. If we are going to entertain philanthropists who are coming from elsewhere globally, what would be the trade-offs of doing that? Yeah. Because then we may end up having to, for example, take in more international students, mm-hmm. and that might not be ideal for South Africa.
So one of the things, and I may have said this to you before, we really, really did appreciate your contribution during COVID. And one of the things we did appreciate, quite honestly, was the fact that you were so accessible. And it's very rare for science to, at a personal level, meet people where they can understand it. And that's what we felt was your contribution through that time during COVID. And the reason I bring this up is that oftentimes universities have sometimes the ability to be these ivory towers in communities where actually the science is supposed to benefit the very community that they're based in, countries and so on. And I think that's one of those things that I think is still missing, where you have these wonderful research papers coming out of universities, but hardly speaking to the people who they're supposed to be benefiting. Your thoughts on how we can better communicate wonderful research and work coming out of universities for it to benefit the greater public?
That's a very important opinion. So if you think about it, the other thing that we've learned during COVID is mistrust of science because of misinformation and disinformation, right? Now people don't even want to take vaccines, and we are now having polio outbreaks and other outbreaks because people don't trust vaccines as a result of some of the misinformation that have occurred. And it is so fragile because, as you say, science is not something that is part and parcel of our daily lives in our communities. It's not something that we interact with every day. We interact with when there's a crisis, when there's a problem. But even then, we still don't trust fully. So I agree with you that during COVID, there was a necessity for science to come out into the public because of the pace at which everything was happening. Mm. Everything was happening so fast, and people needed to know in order to help them know what to do, how to act. But if you think about that same scenario, it's supposed to be happening in our communities every single day as a normal standard practice, where evidence is being made available to the public. But that doesn't happen because we don't have a strong culture of science communication or science diplomacy or science journalism. We don't quite have that. And in fact, we spend a lot of our time in public discourse engaging about just political parties and this and this, and which is fine, it's important to do, but we also have to think about the sort of ways in which we can strengthen the communication of science and make and help our scientists to be comfortable engaging with the public. You're calling it being accessible. You know, we don't reward people for being accessible to the media or the public. There's no reward for it. And the reward comes from either graduating a student or publishing a paper. And those things we ought to do. We need to do them. But we also need to recognize that people making themselves available to the public means time, means effort, means preparation. And we need to recognize it in some ways so that it is worth their time to do that. And it is exactly, and it is part of their work. And our communities also need to know that the funding of our universities is funded, is done through public money, it's tax money. And even though universities have institutional autonomy, they've got academic freedom to explore ideas, they remain publicly accountable to the public. They remain accountable to the public largely because of just the nature of academia in itself. You have to account to the public, but also in South Africa, because we get funded through public funds. So we should not necessarily apologize for having an expectation that science need to provide us with the information to the questions we have, to the dilemmas we have, to the struggles we have as a society. We want, you know, the so-called ivory towers to fall so that we can have scientists come into our communities and say, we've got a problem of load shedding. Put your minds together and solve it for us. We've got a problem of poverty. Put your minds together and solve it for us, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. And there are other things as well, as you know, about communities also being able to feel like they can feed into universities, even though they're not part of the university. And I'm thinking a lot about indigenous knowledge, which resides sometimes in communities where universities are located, and where actually there could be mutually beneficial engagements, but sometimes are not necessarily that way. Yes, you may find that others go out, and anthropologists and so on, but doesn't really reflect what they get back from those communities who do feed that indigenous knowledge.
That's an issue of legitimacy. So I think we are comfortable giving universities legitimacy in South Africa and on the continent as a global phenomenon. We are used to that. But I think we have struggled in South Africa, and I suppose the whole continent, to give legitimacy to indigenous knowledge and knowledge systems. Even the laws in our country are not adequately giving legitimacy to indigenous knowledge. Some people have managed to basically recognize that you can reconcile the two knowledge systems. They don't necessarily have to be in conflict. But we've got historical injustices that have led to that, and that are still manifesting even today. Even all of these things of West versus South, Western versus traditional, and Western versus African, all of those things are parts of historical injustices that those people who don't know about how things evolved over multiple centuries, then take what they see now as normal and forget that actually this would have panned out different if it was designed differently. So I think that, you know, we have to ask ourselves questions why historically and even today, we still struggle to give legitimacy to our indigenous knowledge systems. And if we did, it will be easier for people to be interested in the same way that we're interested in higher education, scientific knowledge, and so forth. Yeah.
You've obviously been very involved and very interested in public health. We've seen your work. Do you think we're ready for NHI?
I think that we are not ready for NHI, but I also think that the principle or the
universal healthcare,
the spirit of the NHI is something that is needed, and it should not wait for us to be ready for it. We will never be ready for things that are going to cause change. Nobody wants disruption, you know, to what's comfortable. And sometimes we just have to make a decision and get on with it and do the best that we can to make it work. I think that, you know, we could be managing the whole process of the NHI better. But I don't necessarily think that it's fair to ask South Africans to keep waiting for equity in healthcare. You know, the divisions that we see between public and private sectors are not just in terms of social justice. We saw during COVID the need for government to buy services in the private sector. We saw the need for the private sector to work closely with the government sector in order to ensure adequate provision of care. That inequality and the sort of inequity that we saw during COVID, where people were about to run out of beds, it's an example of what happens every day that is hidden, that we don't see. But it happens to some people, and it doesn't happen to other people. So my view is, you know, NHI and its intentions are good, but I think we just need to make sure that we ask the right questions to ensure that it's executed well and it's implemented well. And we must not have expectations beyond what it can do. I don't necessarily think that it is designed to improve the quality of healthcare in the facilities. It's designed to provide a financing mechanism. So to now expect it to improve quality is unreasonable. And for government to narrate it as if it will improve quality is also misrepresenting it. It raises expectations in ways that will not be met. And if they're not met, then it will be considered a failure, in as much as it may succeed in restructuring the financing of healthcare in this country. And I can see why those who are currently benefiting from the system may not necessarily want to let go. But I always say that, you know, when they came in to create businesses that they're benefiting from now, they saw a gap in the market. And that's what entrepreneurship is. So they can keep looking for other gaps in the market and show the entrepreneurial skills. So I'm not at all opposed to the spirit of the NHI. I don't think people are also opposed to the spirit of it. I think it's more how it is implemented and executed, and that is a good conversation to have.
You obviously have many goals as you walk into this role, but if you fail at everything else, what's the one thing you really, really want to do well at?
I think that for me, it's really important in the short to medium term for UCT to feel like one organization, one united organization. And I think if you think about it, Pamela, yes, UCT can produce excellent research, but if it's divided, that research will also suffer, and it may not necessarily benefit us per se. But if we try and get UCT to be one organization, but at the same time, get them to do the kind of research and do innovation that can be demonstrated to benefit society, for a top institution like that, it will set a sort of chain reaction for the whole sector, I think, you know, to be able to refocus a little bit more on societal impact rather than just scientific impact. Hmm. And my hope is that the healing that happens at UCT also recognizes that part of the pain is not just because of governance failures, it's frustration that, you know, there is no sense of agency in getting UCT to be a player in our society. You know, someone said society has aspirations. The higher education sector has aspirations for UCT, but society also has aspirations for UCT. Then what is it that society stands to benefit from UCT in order to meet those aspirations? It's not simply when their kids go to UCT, because not all the kids are going to go to UCT, but it's when UCT drives a mission that benefits society in general and leads the sector in getting the sector to attend to the needs of society and meet those aspirations that society has. And for me, if we can set a course, even if we don't necessarily get there, but we start on a journey of going in that direction, it would be really, really good. I think this is a conversation that UCT has to have and discuss and reach a consensus on. Personally, I am not necessarily having a personal agenda of what UCT must do. I'm interested in what consensus UCT can reach in what it needs to do as UCT, because it was there before me, it will remain after me. But if it does not course correct in such a way that it is adaptable to the needs of the 21st century, we might see a situation where UCT becomes irrelevant when society gives up on it, and we don't want to see that.
Wow. Look, we are delighted. Congratulations, and we wish you all of the very best with this journey. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Pamela, and thank you to your listeners. Much appreciated.
And if you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.